Don't give yourself such airs, young lady. It's a wonder you are not with
you Thank you.
What
magic too, from all that happened in the
As of this moment, The Midsummer Marriage appears to be off. At the end of the first act of Sir Michael Tippett's opera, the main couple, Mark and Jennifer, have set off separately on their journeys of enlightenment, she rather more willingly than him, while Jennifer's father, King Fisher, is left plotting against their wedding. Jack, sung by tenor Paul Groves, Jennifer by soprano Erin Wall, King Fisher by baritone David Wilson Johnson, standing in for an indisposed Peter Sidden, Bella by soprano Eilish Tynan, and her sweetheart Jack by tenor Alan Clayton. And that applause and those cheers for the chorus as Sir Andrew Davis brings them to their feet. And now the members of the BBC Symphony Orchestra as well. The BBC Singers, BBC Symphony Chorus and the Symphony Orchestra. Well, in the opera's second act, plans are afoot for a second marriage. And we'll hear Tippett's ritual dances, the famous set pieces that are often played as concert works in their own right, not least here at the BBC Proms over the years. But that's after the first of our two 20-minute interval features, an edited version of the Proms Plus event held earlier this evening across the road at the Royal College of Music. It's introduced by Louise Fryer.
The Midsummer Marriage was premiered in 1955, and it was Tippett's first full-length opera, and with me to discuss it are the composer and broadcaster Michael Barclay, who was a personal friend of Tippett, The repetiteur for this prom and one-time conductor of Morley College Choir, Paul Webster, and Oliver Soden, who's writing a new book about one of the most prominent British composers of the 20th century. Michael, Tippett had found success with his wartime oratorio, A Child of Our Time. I'd like to know why he then decided to turn his hand to a comic opera, especially when he had no necessary possibility of a performance.
Well, it's interesting you use the word comic, because, of course, that is accurate in many ways, and it has very funny things in it. But I don't really think of it as a comic opera. Although, of course, we think of Tippett as being a Beethovenian figure and interested in turbulence and complexity in many ways, this is a very Mozartian idea, that you actually visit human relationships, human frailties. And I think that to be able to put onto a stage, if you like, on a bigger stage, his feelings, slightly confused sometimes about Jungian psychology, appeal to him enormously. And in some ways, rather like Wagner, I almost enjoy the idea of hearing this piece without any staging. In other words, the garden is the garden in your mind, and that is the best and most exciting design you can ever have.
Oliver, your particular interest is in the libretto. Tell us something about the story. Just give us a quick overview, if you can.
Yes, it came to him almost in a dream, before he knew what the opera would be. The opera went through so many incarnations before he even started, you know, about five different titles and scenarios. And this vision of a wood and a landscape, a temple in the distance. And perhaps that's a neat link into the dream world, because one can't actually talk about Tippett or The Midsummer Marriage without talking about Tippett's focus on the importance of dreams, which very much comes from the philosophy of Carl Jung. In a way, the whole opera is a dream. The chorus asks at the end, was it a vision, was it a dream? And this dreamlike quality is, A, so important, but it's so appropriate that the opera sort of came to Tippett in something akin to a dream as well.
Now, Paul, tell us how Tippett goes about creating this magical world.
Well, I think one of the most striking things about this piece, actually, is the quality of luminosity it has on the one hand, but also the darkness that it can inhabit as well, which is clearly very, very much to do with the actual material that he's working with in terms of the drama, i.e. it's about the dark and light sides of the psyche, as he would have said.
Well, and of course, at the heart of Jungian psychology, which Michael was, as I said, very interested in, is this meeting of the anima and the animus, these two things which are in some ways opposite but are absolutely coalesce perfectly. It's meeting the perfect counterpart.
And I think he also, again, in the superscription to A Child of Our Time, which is from, I think it's from Murder in the Cathedral, which is the darkness declares the glory of the light. You cannot have the one without the other.
Yes.
Without its counterpart, it is actually meaningless. Effectively, to the extent it virtually doesn't exist.
Yes.
If you don't have light, then you don't have dark.
Which is played out in the music.
Of course,
not so much light emerging from dark as the ability
to... This is all profoundly sexual.
Yes.
And I mean, that's quite an important thing to say about this music. I think it has sometimes almost riotously sensuous quality to it.
Let's just start with some of the kind of more brooding and mysterious music to suggest that we are simultaneously in the here and now with Bella and Jack, but also in a land of the ancients where all sorts of strange and mysterious activities are going to go on. Now, there's something quite dark, in a sense, about the libretto, which reflects his interest in Eliot and in the wasteland in particular, Oliver.
Yes, well, as we say, darkness in Tippett always has to go hand in hand with light, because the libretto is always about the reconciliation of opposites, be it darkness with light, or, as Michael says, the animus with the anima, i.e., man's sense of the feminine made and woman's sense of the masculine within herself. There is darkness. There is literal darkness in that all of Act Three, hideous for the lighting designer to do, I'm sure, all of Act Three plays out evening going into midnight, and Act Three is set during the shortest night of the year, i.e. Midsummer's Night. And then there are the dark characters, to go right back to the beginning of our conversation, the comic plot, as Michael says, not comic ha-ha, but comic with a capital C, i.e. the conventional comic plot of Shakespeare or of George Bernard Shaw, the obstacle to a marriage, which we know from A Midsummer Night's Dream, say, or numerous other plays. In this opera, these obstacles are quite dark, and they take the form on a literal level of Jennifer's father, Kingfisher, who turns up with a pistol and threatens to shoot everybody until he gets his own way. And on a psychological level, the obstacles are, as we say, these characters have yet to attain some sort of spiritual fulfillment, some sort of spiritual awareness, we might say.
And that that's has very a counterpart, dark, doesn't it, in this idea of pursuit and chase.
Exactly.
Which, of course, is famous in the ritual.
Ritual dances, which Tippett originally called the racing dances. The ritual was a very late development, so the notion of people racing after one another to pursue, as I say, self-fulfillment is very endemic in the work, I think.
Well, let's just have a little musical illustration, first of all, of what Paul was talking about that ascent from darkness to light, and then we'll move on and talk about the ritual dances in more depth after that. I can almost feel my spine lifting as I listen to that.
That is the magic apparatus in this score, the sound of celestial flutes and sometimes muted horns, and that's it in its primary sort of repository. That section is the beginning of Sesostris's narration of the vision, which is obviously central. It's the moment at which the action then revolves, because when she's narrated this, Kingfisher takes objection to what she sees, and that's the point at which he decides to unveil her. So it's a turning point, but that is clearly the most, for me, the most striking example, the most concentrated example of the magic sounds that exist in this score.
Jung has a concept, which Tippett believed in very strongly, that part of our consciousnesses, as it were, has a repressed aspect. There are aspects of our psyches that we do not acknowledge, and in consequence, these aspects are usually negative. And Tippett really does believe it very important to acknowledge the shadow, your dark side, your repressed side, the negative qualities within yourself. And through acknowledging it, you don't shove it onto somebody else. He was very concerned with the idea of the scapegoat. He believed that to be the sort of catalyst for war. So this opera, very much through Mark and Jennifer's descent into the earth, into the underworld, plays with the idea of human beings coming to terms with their own dark side and their own repressed and unacknowledged instincts.
The ritual dances are really very violent, aren't they? I mean, there's no swerving away from the fact that nature is bloody in tooth and claw. Let's have an excerpt. This is, in fact, from the last of the dances. What's happening at that point in the opera?
This is a completion of something in the opera which has been interrupted. There are four ritual dances, as we say, in the opera. Nature taking over and us seeing nature's mating game, as you say, red in tooth and claw. In Act Two, the sort of interlude which comes between the surrounding acts, Acts One and Three, we have the first three ritual dances, which connect one of the four elements, i.e. air, fire, water, etc., with one of the four seasons. We hear the first three in Act Two, and what we've just heard is the completion of the cycle, which comes right at the end of Act Three, which is fire in summer. We're in midsummer, and the fire, which everyone lights in the forest in the middle of the night and is very much seen by Tippett as a cleansing ritual, blazes up into the sky, and the self-fulfillment that the whole opera has been leading to sort of comes in that very moment that we've just heard, where the chorus sings fire, St. John's fire, this is Midsummer Day, St. John's Day, in the desert, in the night. And that is the moment we've all been waiting for, really. It's like the fulfillment of the Tristan chord in Wagner. It really is the completion of the opera and the coming together.
And the wonderful use of that undervalued quality, silence. The space between those chords is what actually makes them stunning.
Yeah. Yes.
And I think also that's a very interesting point. At the very end, the last few pages of this score are quite extraordinary, because the orchestra, as it were, goes one way and the chorus goes the other. That's to say, the chorus is literally going off stage and down the hill, and their music separates out. So as the chorus goes off stage, they are intercut with the orchestra. So the orchestra plays this extraordinary sort of music, and that suddenly is torn off. And the chorus sings a little bit of what they've just been singing a couple of minutes ago, and then that is torn off, and the orchestra comes back again. And the final three pages, there are three statements of this orchestral passage, and they literally stop, and there is absolute silence. And then it rotates again, and there's absolute silence, and the third time round, it actually does come finally to the last chord. But this is the most extraordinary passage and idea. I can't think of anything else quite like it anywhere, actually. I see the most extraordinary bit of invention.
I'm also interested to know, Oliver, why Tippett chose to write his own librettos.
Well, there had been lots of mooted attempts with specific librettists. Tippett wrote a couple of early operas with the poet Christopher Fry, which he then said were not going to be part of his official list of compositions. Then there was a mooted opera with W.H. Auden, which came to nothing. Then he asked T.S. Eliot to write a libretto to the oratorio we've already mentioned, A Child of Our Time. Eliot refused and said, I don't see how any opera composer, or indeed oratorio composer, can do anything other than write his own texts. Partly because Eliot and, I think, Tippett believed that any beautiful qualities in poetry, what we might call verbal music, you know, sort of acoustic qualities in good poetry, would be completely shot into the air by the music of music, as it were. And
I don't think Eliot quite realised what he might be letting us in for with
this
advice.
We should say that Tippett wrote librettos to all five of his operas right until he died, and many other things besides. Also, Tippett just had complete control. He very much didn't like Arthur Bliss's opera, The Olympians, which Covent Garden had premiered a few years before, also rather oddly set at midsummer. I don't know why everybody clustered around this solstice. But he said that Bliss refused to pay any attention really to the libretto, and the structure was all over the place. And I think it's quite Wagnerian. Wagner, of course, uses the word Gesamtkunstwerk, the total artwork. And I think Tippett, through writing his own text, is able to create works that are unique in that he has utter creative control. The text is not to be read as literature, it is to be harnessed by the music. And it allows him very, very, very precisely, I would say, to say what he has to say. If the libretto is confusing, you just listen to the music. Because if the libretto is, and some say it is, a mishmash of cymbals and hodgepodges, there is this sort of magic net of the music. Yeah. Which does pull it all together and explains, to my ears anyway, what's going on.
I think that's absolutely true. It still, I think, to some extent, is subject to this opinion that the Midsummer Marriage, i.e. that there's such a confusion, or supposedly such a confusion in the text, that this still seems, and I find this hard to understand, this still seems to be a barrier to people's appreciation of this piece. I found the first time I heard the whole piece, as opposed to just the ritual dances, it was an utter utter revelation in my life. The sound of this music was quite extraordinary. The sheer luminosity and the energy is absolutely remarkable, I think. And whatever else may or may not be confusing in it, at the end of the day, it stands to my ears on the sound of the music, the sound it makes, as Beecham would have said, you know, it's the noise it makes, you know. Yes. And that is its ultimately its justification, I think.
And Michael was somebody who was absolutely wonderful at keeping to his own vision of what he wanted to do. And so, you know, he wouldn't have worried in a funny way. He'd have laughed, actually. I mean, of course, we all want to be loved, and I'm sure, you know, he'd more like everyone else. But he was somebody who had quite an intense vision of what an artist should be. I remember talking to him about that period of music and saying, did it worry you at all that British music appeared to be sort of 50 years behind the continent? And he actually got quite angry and said, not at all. He thought that what British composers were doing at that time, Walton, Britten, my father, was very important, had their own voice, and they shouldn't be aping the continent. And that, in fact, the fact that they did not was a quality. Well, we could all debate that in many ways, but we're talking about him, and that was his view. I mean, he felt very strongly, and then we haven't talked about his, you know, looking back to people, the Madrigal composers, the people he conducted at Morley College, you know, Purcell and things like that. He had a very strong feeling about who he was as a British composer, and he was very proud of it.
What images do you think we will take home with us tonight?
Although the orchestra is not particularly large, I think it's a big piece and it needs space because it spreads a lot. It spreads out a lot in time. It's like Wagner, you know, hier wird die Zeit das Raum in Parsifal, here time becomes space. And I think therefore, because this piece stretches out in time, it's got there's a bigness about it, which I think is well suited to a large performing space, actually.
There is such a...
It's generous, isn't it?
Oh, it's generous, and it's also sort of vertical, in that, as you will hear, if not see, in the first act, Jennifer ascends a spiral staircase into heaven, and Mark goes down into the earth, into Hades. And the sort of vertical cavernousness of the Albert Hall will be, you know, very useful for imagining staircases going up into the beyond.
And, of course, historically, this is very important because, you know, Britain had got opera going in this country with Grimes. And the fact that we had another composer producing works of the quality of Midsummer Marriage and King Priam meant that, you know, that he wasn't acting alone, Britain, that we actually had different ways of looking at opera.
Yes.
And that was very important in the history of British music.
And we can all enjoy it tonight. Michael Barclay, Oliver Soden, Paul Webster, thank you very much.
That was an edited version of the Proms Plus event held earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music. It was introduced by Louise Fryer and produced by Helen Garrison. And don't forget that there is a Proms Plus feature associated with every prom in the season. You'll find details of them all in the Proms Guide and also on the BBC Proms website. You're listening to the BBC Proms here on Radio 3 with Andrew McGregor at the Royal Albert Hall for this concert performance of Sir Michael Tippett's 1955 opera, The Midsummer Marriage, conducted by Sir Andrew Davis, as we celebrate Tippett's music at the 2013 Proms, 15 years after his death. It would have been lovely to be able to talk to the composer about the opera. Last time I saw Tippett was at the Glyndebourne production of his sci-fi epic New Year back in 1990, but we have found a clip of Tippett talking to Roy Plumley on Desert Island Discs, telling him how The Midsummer Marriage came into being.
I had written operas before, quite a number of them, of various kinds, and it sounds rather grand, but I had been constantly in the theatre. And so I came to feel that I knew what the opera that I wanted to write should be, and that it should be an opera which should have two great things behind it. One was Mozart, which was The Magic Flute, which therefore was an opera about illumination, and getting there, you see, at the point at which the vision appears. And the other was The Midsummer Night's Dream of Shakespeare, because Shakespeare was the absolute, always has been, I mean, the theatre. It's a wonderful world of tremendous variety. Out of these came this belief that I could put somewhere upon the stage this going from this world of the everyday into the theatre of magic.
Didn't he just, as we're finding out this evening at the Proms. Sir Michael Tippett talking to Roy Plumley on BBC Radio 4's Desert Island Discs back in 1985, and that's an edition you can hear in full online from the Desert Island Discs archive on the Radio 4 website. Well, for this Proms performance of The Midsummer Marriage, we don't have any staging or opera house production to distract us from Tippett's ravishing music. Kenneth Richardson's stage direction here is a model of economy and simplicity. So, at the end of Act 1, the marriage is on hold while the bride and groom set off in opposite directions on their journeys of self-discovery and spiritual enlightenment. Mark and Jennifer are the Tamino and Pamina figures Tippett borrowed from Mozart's Magic Flute. The other couple are in much better shape, as we're about to find out. Papageno and Papagena reincarnated as Jack and Bella. As the chorus wanders the woods, singing under the bright midsummer sun, Bella asks Jack to hang behind. She proposes to him, and they dream together of settling down, renting a little house, looking forward to the arrival of a little Jack or Bella, and singing a lullaby to the baby. As they walk dreamily into the wood together, Tippett's ritual dances begin. First, the earth in autumn, for which, in Tippett's detailed stage directions, we see two dancers as a hound hunting a hare which escapes behind the temple. More dancers are disguised as the roots of great trees, and they come to life to set out the course of a river in the second ritual dance, the waters in winter. This time, it's a fish being chased by an otter and getting stuck amongst the water nymphs as it tries to escape. The river disappears and the dancers sow a field of spring corn for the third ritual dance, the air in spring. A bird with a broken wing is pecking in the cornfield under the shadow of a descending hawk. The exhausted bird seems unable to escape, to the horror of Bella, who's been watching the dance with Jack and seems to think that the hawk dancer really meant to kill the one portraying the bird. Jack calms her down, and she settles herself by taking a mirror from her handbag and applying her makeup. Face back on, she's ready to rejoin King Fisher, who, to Jack's alarm, apparently has another role for them to play. As he chases after her, in an echo of the ritual dances, the chorus returns and then dies away into stillness at the end of the second act. Well, Jack is sung by Alan Clayton and Bella by Eilish Tynan. Stephen Bryant's just finishing tuning the BBC Symphony Orchestra. And here to conduct the BBC Singers Symphony Orchestra and Chorus in the second act of Tippett's opera, The Midsummer Marriage, it's Sir Andrew Davis. It's the afternoon, and Bella has something she wants to say to Jack.